great. We're going to be in New Orleans. We're going to be in the southern United States. We could talk about, you know, the South has persistent sort of inequities and structural inequities. We could address that. It's healthography, right? New Orleans has a great history of being deeply resistant to public health intervention, even though the city is destroyed and abandoned over and over by cholera and yellow fever. But, you know, so I said, you know, we can really talk about these things. And one of my colleagues says, you know, I think this can be addressed by, like, individual resiliency models, you know, which I thought was a strange thing to think. So I was talking about this. And, you know, my interest is, as a lawyer, is thinking about, well, what are the, what frames the way we address these policy problems and these individual, why is individualism sort of like, you know, wagon wheel ruts in a road where you can, you sort of get just sort of stuck in it. So I also am going to play very fast and very loose with American history and sort of big themes, which I hope will sort of generate a lot of conversation. This is me. I have no disclosures. This might be a really hard thing to do. So, like I said, my goal here is to trace some very big sort of themes. And I thought I would start with yellow fever and also cholera to some extent in the 19th century. And to sort of think about the United States as the 19th century, you know, the Civil War, and is also characterized by repeated and ongoing epidemics of these very serious infectious diseases. With many southern cities, New Orleans in particular, sort of being emptied, you know, by most of the population either dying or fleeing, right, and then returning. And if we look at that history, there's a certain point where the United States and the federal government sort of got tired of this repeated behavior, and we were close to having a national health board, a national public health system. And then we get the Spanish-American War, and like many things in U.S. history, the conflict intervenes or something, a crisis comes, and the idea of a national public health board is sort of shelved, right? And you have the Reed Commission, we figure out what causes yellow fever, so on and so forth. We then, you know, there's also this early movement of the populace in American history, primarily agrarian, farmers, resistant to ongoing industrialization, and making a very significant move in American politics in the late 19th century and early 20th century, which was ultimately unsuccessful in its attempt to influence American politics in a significant way. And the progressives sort of come in. I mean, the progressives are the big P. And what I think is interesting about them, and is what a historian at the time said about the progressives, is that they, you know, they caught the populace in swimming and stole all their clothes, right? So the populace, I mean, the progressives sort of portrayed themselves as, you know, populist, but in reality had very little of the same interest. The Progressive Party, to some extent, is predominantly middle class. They favored industrialization. Their resistance to, their problems with industrialization were not industrialization itself, they just wanted better products and safer products, right? They saw industry as the means and the future to satisfy individual personal growth and individual personal desire. So for the progressives, the problem is not industry, and it's not industrialization. It is this idea of it needs to be better regulated, it needs to make better products. And in tied to that, you see the growth of the consumer movement, which is a very large sort of political movement in the early 20th century. The consumer movement, I'm arguing, is predominantly, if not exclusively, focused entirely on the individual. The idea of the consumer movement was only to provide safer and better products that were properly labeled. The consumer's desire was enshrined as paramount, and the idea of a rational consumer making decisions based on clear information drove everything. So this is Your Money's Worth, which was a very famous manual during the period, where the idea was, with the right amount of information, with the right ingenuity and industry, the individual, the homemaker, could put their time and attention on saving money, being thrifty, improving themselves. So the idea of the consumer movement was better living through better products, right? And we can do that with partnership with industry. And I think this is important because I think it helped lay the foundations of what in some ways becomes a dominant theme in our public health movement. One of the first pieces of legislation that I would refer to is the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. As I talk about all these things, I think there are, they did great things, right? These laws are important. They're important to people. They're important for society. But they also have a very deeply individualistic focus. And the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, these early rules and laws about foods and drugs were important. People were selling poison as drugs, right? That is dangerous. People were being killed. But at the same time, these were seen as industry regulations, not safety regulations, right? They're regulating industry. They want proper labeling, safe products, and not really a focus on the public health per se, I would argue. Spinning much further ahead. And I'm going kind of rapidly because I want to suggest there are two kind of problems that this causes for us in solving some current problems. Nader and auto safety we can think about in the 60s. You know, very important. Safer cars, right? Safer transport. But the focus wasn't on what's the best kind of transportation policy we should have, right? Not an emphasis on public transit. It's just a better and safer car, right? So the idea is very much in this line of better and safer cars for individuals to actualize themselves. I would also point to the health promotion movement. The principles of the Ottawa Charter. And I think this is very dominant at APHA and very dominant in our rhetoric now. The idea of we support environments for individual health, right? So the idea is to create the environment and then help the individual actualize themselves, right? That we focus healthcare services to wellness services. These are all admirable goals, but I don't think they're public health goals. And that we help people develop personal skills. I think we can also look in the United States at HIV and AIDS and the role of the gay and lesbian community, the gay community predominantly, ACT UP, treatment activists. This is important, but it also had the effect of coupling HIV and AIDS treatment to a civil rights issue, right? And when you couple stuff to a civil rights issue, it's rights language, it's individual language, right? It makes it very hard to shift to sort of a public model. I would point to Citrus Hill, the Nutrition Labeling and Education Act. Does anyone remember this? The FDA commissioner went to a grocery store in Florida, I think, with the Citrus Hill juice. So Citrus Hill juice is predominantly sugar water being sold as fresh juice. And it was part of the impetus of the passage of the Nutrition Labeling and Education Act. And the problem that the Nutrition Labeling Education Act is trying to solve is not that you're selling sugar water label, right? You can sell sugar water, fine. Just label it as sugar water, right? And I think for me, working in food policy at the time, and for others, it was, well, you shouldn't really be selling sugar water, right? And labeling it as juice, even if that is what it is. So, but the same thing, the Nutrition Labeling and Education Act, its goal is to regulate industry primarily and to give you the information you need to make the choices you need to eat that. Right? It doesn't actually do anything about the food environment. And then my favorite, we've all seen this, right? It's like being at church. It's like the mantra we chant, right? The IOM definition of public health. And it itself enshrines this idea. It's about environments to help people be healthy, right? And in some ways, I was doing some work on a paper, this paper, and things I'm worth thinking about. And this definition was established by asking everyone who works in the field, right? So in some ways, this is sort of a self-referential, I don't know that it has any content or any sort of thought behind sort of what actually public health is, except to capture what people in 1988 thought public health was, and still operating within those promotion models. Okay. Oh, it goes quickly. So current public health law, we have a panel on Wednesday in the law section. We'll talk about this more. But our current models in this area that public health lawyers to think about these problems are also influenced by this. They're mostly balancing individuals versus collective needs, focused on consequences, and really good only about looking at snapshot problems like now. Right? And I think that's important for several reasons. So why does it matter? I'm not going to go into great detail about climate change. I I believe it is perhaps the most profound public health problem we currently face. And I think this individual approach makes things like climate change hard to solve. Climate change is complex. It transcends individual and political constituencies. And our models are not very good at thinking about how to think about problems without a constituency. They also tend, the actions around climate change tend to benefit an unknown and unrepresented future group. And by that I mean, if we do work on solving climate change right now, the primary benefit is not to us. This may be to our children's children, right? It is very hard to think about future and non-existent groups as having individual rights claims, right? They get overrided by the current. And the current models with this idea of balancing, it's hard to think about these kinds of problems. The last, I think, is inequities in the United States. The health inequities in the U.S. are not evenly distributed. And I think it is very hard to think about addressing these things at a level of the structural determinant when we are based on these individualist sort of models. I'm going to go fast. So in terms of future directions, I would suggest sort of historical and legal investigation of what was going on in the 19th century and before. Right? In some ways, can we view 20th century sort of American public health as possibly an aberration in the long history of public health, right? But somehow we've gotten off track and need to think about, you know, paternalism's okay. The public is okay. That's the point. And maybe these panels are a first step of doing that. And I was interested in Bruce Jennings, who was arguing along these lines, and it was very influential for me, that we should really think about public health as public service, as disinterested and reflective action. And the key things he focuses on that I think are important is the idea of when we work in public health, we don't work for ourselves nor for anyone we represent. We work for the public, which is an idea in and of itself, that stands on its own. That we need to create systems that are free from arbitrary domination, which is one of his ideas. I would suggest that persistent inequities, for example, in the southern United States, is an external and arbitrary domination of someone. It is not the same for people living in this part of the country as if for people in other parts of the country, and it's not right, right? That we focus again on civic virtue and the idea of the civic life together, and we go back to the idea of the public and really pushing towards the Roman idea of the res publica, right? That we have a common life, and this common life transcends private affairs and the individual. And I think Dan is exactly correct in his analogy of a marriage, right? Even when the individuals in a marriage are gone, the marriage is still there, right? It's not just the sum of two people. We can think of the public as a value in and of itself. And so when we come together and when we think about public health, our goals are not our constituencies or the people we come from, but is to think about our public life together and our civic life together. And I am right on time.
Oh,
thank
great.
You.
So I'm reminded of the wisdom of Garrett Hardin in the 60s when he published The Tragedy of the Commons, which, in my opinion, should be the first thing every student in public health reads, because what it says is that group-level problems require group-level solutions. You can't solve group-level problems with solutions that are based on individualism. What we're coping with now is the question of, okay, if we buy that idea as a movement, public health as a movement buys that idea, but what are the values, the norms, the morality of those group level solutions? Because an awful lot of bioethics has been focused on the values of individual choice and medicine, which I think gets us right to Daniel's presentation. Daniel Goldberg is a faculty member at the East Carolina University. We started with a discussion from a person with a PhD, and then a lawyer, and then we end with somebody who has both a law degree and a PhD in history of ideas. Is that what you
medical humanities.
Medical humanities, okay. It's also because five initials after your name are not sufficient. He's also getting an MPH as well, which I think is great. He does his work in ethical implications of social determinants of health inequities. I know he's done a lot of work in stigma and chronic pain, both looking at those issues both domestically and globally. Anyway.